On the stations of Coast Community Radio and on demand at coastradio.org, you are listening to Village Square, a locally produced public affairs program. This is your host, Michel Mayfron. Welcome to all of you. Our guest today is Dr. Joanne Stefanelli, the medical examiner for Clatsop County, Oregon. Dr. Stefanelli, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
First, can you please tell our audience what the medical examiner does and what your duties are?
Well, I was appointed about 10 years ago as the medical examiner. In this county, it's a little different than what people see on television, actually. In this county, we have a system, not in this county, in the state, we have a system where each county has a physician who is the local medical examiner. That means they're the chief death investigator for the county. And what that means is I investigate all accidental deaths, homicides, suicides, and any death that is unexpected or suspicious. I also get called by police who go to home deaths where someone dies in their home. I also get called by the emergency rooms. This is done so that I can spot trends that may be occurring in the county that might be important in terms of something that would be epidemiologically important, such as anthrax. All the autopsies, though, are done in Portland by the forensic pathologists. They don't go to the scenes there, they have investigators. Some feel that, well, that kind of gives me the short end of the stick because I don't get to do the most fun part, but I totally disagree. I really think it gives me a tremendous advantage to go to all these scenes where I pick up on cues that the doctors who do the autopsy really don't have. So I enjoy doing just this part of it.
So talking about forensic investigations and the TV shows, is there one in particular that's more realistic than the others that you would recommend to our audience from that point of view?
I think the most realistic one is Dr. G, Medical Examiner. I feel that she, in addition to having sort of an interesting personality and very receptive to her audience, she presents it realistically. Now, the part that I do would be the part that's brought to her, and then she reviews it before she starts the autopsy. But the reason she's very effective is because she is realistic about time frames, and you get to know that even weeks later, you get more information. The CSIs and the ilk of that whole series is that things are not instantaneous. DNA in this state can sometimes not be obtained for 6 months to a year, depending on the case. And toxicology realistically takes full 6 weeks.
How long have you been the medical examiner, and what was the process that led to your selection for the position?
I've been the medical examiner since 2001, which makes it now going on my 10th year. I was appointed by the county commission by recommendation of the district attorney. At the time, I had been practicing as a gynecologist, obstetrician gynecologist, for about 4 years. I went then to the Child Abuse Assessment Center, the Lighthouse, and was their medical director for about a year and a half. By working with the police there and the district attorneys there, they needed a doctor to do this job, and this isn't a job most people like to do, but it appealed to my detective sense and my real interest in pathology. So from my appointment then, I went up to Portland, took classes, worked with the forensic pathologist, and really got to know the field before I started, since this wasn't my initial field of education.
Enough of the question that you were expecting. You are well known in the area for having brought babies into the world for years, and now you're dealing with dead people investigating the circumstances of their passing. Those are two pretty contrasted sets of experiences. What have you learned from them as a doctor and as a person?
I get this question fairly often, because it is a little unusual to go from, you know, being the hero and delivering babies and, you know, having all this happiness to really one of the most depressing jobs I could ever think of. However, you know, it was a privilege to share in the moment of a child's birth with the family, and each one was unique, and many were actually quite terrifying. But in all honesty, dealing with death has taught me a whole lot more about life. I now take pride in being the person to be there at the worst moment of the lives instead of at the happiest. I prefer, actually, this job. I find it better for me as a person. It's taught me a lot about what's really important in life. And let me tell you, it's a whole lot harder to say to a mother that I'm sorry to have to tell you this than it's a boy.
Well, in the NCIS series, which is a favorite in our family, the forensic pathologist actually talks to the dead people and ask questions. What sort of relationship do you have with the people that you examine?
It's really kind of cute. That's one of my favorite shows, and you didn't even know that. I actually think it's pretty cool, and I talk to my patients all the time. I get the weirdest looks from the policemen who are there because they think I'm kind of weird. But I do. It's like, oh, you know, you poor thing. What happened to you? And I'm their spokesman. They can't talk anymore. And so I feel that if somebody has to speak up for them, and I don't care what it is they did, I don't care, how pained they were, what a bad person they were, that isn't for me to judge. I'm very protective of respect for the patient, and I talk to mine all the time, too. So I'm glad that I don't, seem too weird. I'm glad, someone else does it, too.
Zeroing in on the area of drug and alcohol and on the consequences of abuse and addiction, what do you observe these days from your vantage point as a medical examiner? What are the killers out there?
Well, when I first started, I wasn't really sure. This was a job that, was kind of new to me. And, I'm a decent doctor, so I kind of knew what to look for medically. But a few of the scenes started to be quite unusual. And I guess in this county, as I'll explain later, alcohol is a big killer. Many of the people that die, die at home without medical care that are obviously, the homes are filled with bottles, empty bottles, and the person has got every sign of liver disease. This is really quite common, and it's quite prevalent in the area. What I came to see is not a lot of heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine like you would think, and actually what started to become the main killer in the county was prescription drugs. I found that this led to more people's deaths and continues to lead to more people's deaths than the illegal drugs combined.
Would you say then that there is an opiate epidemic raging out there? Statistics are grim. 26 people died in the county in the last 3 years as a result of addiction to methadone, morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, heroin.
There's absolutely a problem. In fact, it's bigger here, it seems, than it is even in Portland. The people in Portland, the medical examiner's office, sort of chuckle when they speak of our little county up here. They used to call the area from Tillamook to, it'd probably be about St. Helens, the triangle of death from Portland. And they meant drugs. I mean, they meant it, and it's serious. Actually, we've become a center where people find it easy to get prescription drugs from the doctors here. People that we hear come deliberately here to get the prescription drugs that they're seeking. So it's huge.
Does this affect all groups in our society?
Yes. I'd like to say that it's only, problem of the who you would think, the poor, people that don't have jobs, the people that, sit around and do nothing. But that isn't actually the case. It's actually a problem that goes across societal lines. It goes across socioeconomic barriers. It goes to everyone. This is an addiction problem that is actually epidemic in the United States. I don't know if you've ever seen the film The OxyContin Express, but it's an incredible, incredible, and very true documentary that was made. You can find it online, and I recommend people seeing it because it is the way it is. Now, OxyContin is not big around here because it's too expensive, and we don't have a population that gets OxyContin. And the reason why is the state welfare programs, the Medicaid, Oregon Health Plan won't pay for it. So they pay for another drug, methadone, which we can talk about in a few minutes.
So what do you think are some of the causes of the epidemic?
I think about this probably daily, because I deal with probably an overdose or so every week or so, or some three in a week, some I don't have for three, four weeks. And I do a lot of thinking about this, and I think the vast majority of what I see is people just don't do anything else. I think that a lot of them don't have jobs because their addictions become their lives. The seeking of the prescription medications becomes what they do. It becomes their job. It becomes their whole life. And when you do that, you can't work. And when they don't work, they don't do anything else. And so the basic story I see is people who don't keep themselves engaged in life. I don't see that people pay attention much to their families. The families are hurting. The families know there's a problem. So I tend to think that it comes from lack of things to do more than anything else. Does unemployment affect it? Absolutely. I think the economy is one of the reasons I'm seeing a resurgence of methadone, mostly methadone overdoses in the area. When I first got here in 2001, that was my very first case. If I may tell you about that, it was a 42-year-old woman, and I went to her bedside, and there were more narcotics than I have seen in one place in my entire life. And of course, me being a doctor, I said, oh, this person must have a terrible cancer. I felt so bad for her. Well, I talked to her very reluctant doctor to talk to me, and actually, she didn't have anything. She had back pain. And I was floored. I absolutely floored about the quantities that I was seeing of narcotics. Results of an autopsy and toxicology, you know, revealed at that time it was an overdose of morphine. And this pattern played out now for the last 10 years. It's just more and more common. More young women. It's a lot women, a few men, and it's always pretty much the age group between 30 and 50. And it's a terrible, terrible age where people have their whole lives ahead of them, and it's quite tragic.
Is chronic pain, back pain, for example, a frequent gateway to the use of opiates?
Yes, I think initially, you know, it's interesting. You know, chronic pain is a very difficult area to talk about. Having not experienced chronic pain on more than a six-month, you know, ordeal, I can't comment, but I actually think a lot of people start with chronic pain. And then they find out that these drugs make them feel pretty darn good. And then they have to feel that way all the time. So it goes from curing their pain to maintaining euphoria. And when you maintain euphoria with narcotics, it takes more and more and more all the time. So then finding the drug itself becomes the problem rather than the chronic pain. They can lie to themselves, but I think in many cases, the amount of pain medication these people are taking would choke a horse, and I'm sure their pain isn't there, but the euphoria isn't anymore, and that's what they're chasing. And that's just very, very, very sad.
Among that class of medications, methadone is particularly dangerous.
That's right. You know, it kind of went in a pattern. Initially, I saw a lot of morphine with Vicodin, oxycodone, hydrocodone for breakthrough. And then it went from morphine to the fentanyl patches. Those were especially lethal. Fentanyl is a drug that's 10 times as potent as morphine, and it's worn in a patch. And I'm certainly not going to tell you how to make that patch more potent, but it doesn't take long for people to find out the ways to make it more potent. But doing that was very, very dangerous. Now, haven't seen a fentanyl patch death in quite a while, which makes me think that there's less being prescribed, which is great. It was actually given a black box warning because of the deaths. So then I started to see a fall off from that, and then an increase in methadone. Now, methadone is a completely different drug than Vicodin and oxycodone. The reason why is methadone is a drug that stays in your blood for about 24, sometimes 48 hours, and sometimes longer. However, the euphoria does not. The euphoria, which is the, you know, the feeling good part of it, lasts for only 6 to 8 hours. So people then will dose themselves again to get the euphoria. Sometimes they then, if they wake up in the middle of the night, they have pain or they want to feel better, they take more. And if they don't keep track, if they happen to be sleeping when all of the drugs and all of the levels come together, if they're sleeping, they don't wake up, because it depresses the respiratory center. So this is a really, really dangerous drug that I don't believe everybody understands the mechanism of.
Are there any particular heartbreaking stories about maybe young people becoming addicted and eventually dying from their addiction?
Yes, but most in the area that are young are actually not addictions. The couple that I've had that are young have been more just using it to get high and not realizing the combination of alcohol and Xanax and hydrocodone and methadone. The methadone's going to get you if you're not awake when it peaks. You know, there was a case locally of a child, I consider it, to being addicted. But hopefully that has, I haven't seen a lot of prescribing for children, as I call anyone under 18, for this drug because of its danger.
So what would you say to people who are dabbling in opiates?
Well, I'd tell them to be darn careful and to think long and hard about what they're doing. What I see is a pattern. And, you know, initially the people take the medication as prescribed for the pain. And that's fine, because as the doctor prescribes it, you're not going to get into trouble in most cases, because they're very careful doctors about how they prescribe the medications because they know their danger. However, what happens about 2 years after they start playing with doses, and what I mean is they start taking drugs that are other people's drugs, or doubling the amount that they're supposed to take, or combining it with alcohol, or combining it with Xanax, or a multitude of other things, they start getting very cocky and thinking, you know, this is not going to beat me. You know, other people can die, but it's not going to be me. But, I mean, I might have a really selective population since mine are all dead, but the two-year pattern is remarkable. I will talk to the families, and they absolutely tell me that it's about 2 years that they've been playing this game, doctor shopping, going to different urgent cares, going to different ERs, in addition to what they're getting from their regular doctor. And these people know how to do it with multiple pharmacies. They go to, the death a couple weeks ago, this gentleman had 7 different pharmacies and 8 different doctors just in the last year, which is terrible. If we all knew that this was happening, the doctors subsequent to the first one wouldn't have prescribed it, I wouldn't think, for this gentleman. And his playing around, you know, led directly to his death.
Do you feel the medical profession has some responsibility in this situation?
I do. I do in some respects, not in all. There's a couple different patterns that I've noted. Sometimes the over-prescribing, what I mean is, there's a certain level that pretty much all of us are comfortable in giving patients, which means you don't give them usually more than 100 of something, because people are funny. If you give somebody 300 of something, boy, you know, they tend to want to take 10 instead of taking 6, because they know they can last longer. So most of us are pretty reliable. Most of the doctors in this county are pretty reliable about how they prescribe. There have been a few who are egregious in their prescribing. I mean, prescribing amounts that I really are so over the top that nobody could think that's okay. And in that respect, I think it is definitely the doctor's responsibility. More so than the vast majority of us who try to prescribe the right way. We do drug tests. We want to see if the patients are taking what they're giving. We want to see they're not taking methamphetamine. We want to see they're not taking cocaine. Because these are the things that tend to lead to, you know, misuse and diversion of the medications. So, you know, it's an interesting conundrum in some ways. You know, we try to control it, but we're accused as a profession of not caring about chronic pain of these patients, and it's a hard dilemma to figure out, you know, what's right. Are they lying? Are they not lying? Between do they really have pain, and what right do I have to say they don't?
Is it your impression that also dentists are paying attention to the amount of pain medication that they prescribe?
Yeah, dentists are great. Dentists are great. They, boy, when you know, I've had tooth abscesses, and they've given me, you know, 2 or 5 of something. And legitimately, that's really all you need, because within a day, you know, you basically need an Advil from then on. They're very responsible. I don't really think a whole lot of doctors locally, I don't see a real problem in Clatsop County right now either. I think we're pretty lucky.
This brings the question about pain management and formats for pain management. Is the medical profession reluctant to specialize in that area for whatever reason?
Well, that's an interesting question. I find that it's actually the people who want to practice medicine versus making money. And I know that might sound funny, but there are purists out there, you know, of which my husband, me, most of the doctors in this county are of that ilk. We want to practice medicine. We don't want to spend 75% of our day talking to patients about chronic pain and deciding who's really got pain and who wants the euphoria. So there's a dichotomy. There is, however, this cadre of physicians who, if you watch the OxyContin Express, actually are making a living, quite a nice living. And so we find in the area, even around here or neighboring counties and states, that there are people who are really not specialized in pain management, but that is the substance of what they do. And it's fairly lucrative. So I think you have to have a certain personality to deal with narcotics all day, and I think the vast majority of us don't have that personality, which is great.
Going back to the families, what is the effect on the families who are losing their loved ones to those drugs? Do you interact with them, first of all?
Yes, that's the hardest part. First, it sort of goes in stepwise fashion. First of all, I try to make sure that I talk about whatever medical problems this patient have, even though I know full well that it's an overdose. I try to, give credence to the family, listen to what they're telling me. And then I, before I start saying anything, I go and I speak to the doctor who prescribed or whatever for the patient, find out their medical history, review that. And then it becomes the hard part, which is revealing to the family that I feel this is an overdose. It runs the gamut. And it is one of the most painful talks that I have, and I've done it now hundreds of times. And it's interesting to see the dichotomy. The spouses of these people are basically kept in the dark that I've seen. The spouses often have no idea the addiction or the taking of meds had gone to this level. But the real pain that I see is these people's children, because they haven't fooled them. If it's a teenage child and if they're in the room when I'm discussing it, they often are quite aware of their parents' addiction, even more so than the spouse, because they see the changes in the personality of the parent. And just like when you did something bad when you were a kid and you know when to approach your dad to tell him and apologize, you knew you weren't going to do it when he was in a certain mood. Well, these kids know when their parent is high, and they've honed that skill. So it often is no surprise to the children, and it actually is rather comforting, because these children have told me that they worry about finding their parent dead, and now they finally are, and so now they can rest. And it is one of the most tragic, hard things that I do, and I have to do it way too often.
At this point, what is our recourse as a community? What can we do to curtail the epidemic? Are there some solutions there that you can identify?
This is a hard question. I've done a lot of thinking about this, because I can sit on my soapbox and say whatever I want about what's going on, but what am I doing, or what can we do as a community? I feel that, first of all, providing mental health for a lot of these people. I know that a lot of these people are dealing with abuse. I see many, many, many of the patients who die have been abused in childhood and really have never dealt with it. I'm not saying that if they had counselors, they would tell them, but providing a really high level of mental health care would be great. And I don't see that's really, we're struggling. We're struggling because of money, of course. Jobs would help, keeping people busy. But I find that in most of my cases, these people are disabled strictly because of their chronic pain or their addiction or both. Education. I think it's important to do things like this. That I'll talk to any group, and that's true. I will talk to any group they want me to talk to, including the schools. I would love to get into the high schools, though I don't know. They, as a group, tend to think that everyone else would die and not them. But I would love to try, because my motto is, if I can prevent one death, it's worth it.
What about the registry? The registry of pharmacies, would that be helpful? More communication, more electronic connection between
yes.
the pharmacies?
Yes, in fact, it's a proposed bill in Oregon right now. Now, California has it already. What we mean is the controlled substances are put on a central registry. And so if I'm in my urgent care and I suspect that, Joe Blow is trying to scam me, I can call up and find what controlled substances Joe Blow has gotten in the last a couple of years, or where the pharmacies are. I'm suspicious when, you know, people come from Portland and they come down here seemingly for no reason, and I'd be able to check to see what they've gotten recently. It would help tremendously, because you can call somebody on it. You know, the way that we doctors feel, if you ask the question and you say, are you getting pain meds from anyone else, and they tell you no, and you find out that they have, you no longer really have any obligation to listen to what that patient said, because they've lied. So it would help tremendously in curtailing that part of this. So I feel that that will help tremendously in this respect.
Dr. Stefanelli, we are now almost at the end of our show. Are there additional insights that you would like to share with our listeners before we close?
Oh, I'm not sure. I guess to those out there, and I'm sure there are some people listening who are having this problem and really do understand that it's the euphoria they're looking for, not the chronic pain, and you are the people I'm aiming this at, not the people who take their medications the right way and for the pain that they truly have. But I don't see those a whole lot. You know, I see the people in the community with the most disabling arthritis. You know, they're the people at the pool. They're the people doing water exercises. They're the people doing shiatsu. They're the people doing massage, herbs, anything. So I guess my message is, really be honest with yourself. If these are your problem, are you looking for the euphoria? And if so, you know, try to find any other modality. Try anything. Just get off the couch, walk your dog. We all have dogs. They all like to be walked. You know, get off the couch in front of the TV and just start to move and be more interactive with your families. And I think be more honest with yourself, because this is you're heading for a meeting with me.
An unscheduled meeting.
Yes, that's for sure.
Well, Dr. Stefanelli, thank you very much. We are lucky as a community to have you as our medical examiner. Thank you for the important information you've shared with us today. This is Michel Mayfran signing off. Have a wonderful day. We will see you all again next month on the Village Square.
Thank you.
Singala, una figi manga doro kibati singala, kifarala.